Welcome in to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Folks, today's show I have been looking forward to for quite a while. I'll tell you why. We all have that experience in our life. When we're talking about paranormal experiences, it's the experience that changes the way we think about life and death. The experience that changes the way we think about paranormal investigating and the experience that changes our lives in general. Our guest today is a man that you've probably seen on television, is a man that you've probably thought, well, I wonder what changed his world and changed his life. He actually has a book out there right now, actually is coming out soon. It'll be out there soon enough. It'll come out on September 8th, that will tell you exactly what changed his life. And I'll tell you, it is a fascinating book, folks, that will tell you how his life changed. It's called The Horrors of the House of Wills, a true story of a paranormal investigator's most terrifying case. And I'll tell you who this investigator is. It's Daryl Marson. He is the co-lead investigator on A&E's Ghost Hunters. He has led more than, and you may ask, well, where can I see that A&E's Ghost Hunters? It's on Disney Plus right now. He has led more than 400 paranormal investigations of private homes and historical locations, such as the House of Wills. He hosts the popular podcast, The American Ghost Hunter Show, and co-owns the website Paranormal Warehouse, which reports on paranormal news. You can visit him online at paranormalwarehouse.com. Let's welcome in to Darkness Radio, Daryl Marson. Hi, Daryl. How are you doing?
Good, man. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Doing well. I got to tell you, my friend, was I chilled by this book. I was enthralled with this book. I picked up this book. I didn't put it back down. I rarely go through a book in one shot and read it from beginning to end, cover to cover. Normally, I take a break from it. I walk away from it. I come back to it. I digest it a little bit. I didn't do that with this book. I went from beginning to end because I couldn't put it down. And I think that's because there is a relatability to this. And we all have that experience. We have that one experience that moves us. Tell me, first of all, why? Why write this book about your first experience?
Well, first of all, thank you for those compliments. I've been hearing that a lot from the people who have been able to review the books, people, you know, such as you, before it came out, about how they're able to read it in one or two, you know, sittings, and they don't want to put it down. And for me, a first time author, that's like, I'm humbled by that. I really am. But I mean, why I really wrote this book was, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, it was a thing where I was asked. I've done radio shows and podcasts and things of that nature, and everyone always, one of the big questions they ask is, you know, what's your scariest experience? What's the scariest location you've ever been to? And my number one is always the House of Wills. And it came down to the point after 5 or 6 years of talking about this, people were asking, hey, you should write a book about it. Mm-hmm. And so COVID hit. I was sitting on my butt for a good 6-7 months. And I said, well, let me write this book. I mean, I'd never written a book before. I never wanted to be an author. And I sat down one night and just started writing this thing about, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't stop for almost 3-4 months. It just kind of flowed. And it, quite honestly, it was therapy for me to get it all out, because I had like buried a lot of it, what happened to me there, because a lot of it I couldn't digest at the time. I wasn't as a mature investigator as I am now. Mm-hmm. I'd only been, you know, investigating for 8 or 9 years at that point. And it really humbled me. And it was that location that almost made me quit investigating altogether, because I'm like, if this is how it's going to be, and I don't want to ever run into a place like this again. And I have since several locations, but none that actually, you know, measure up to the House of Wills, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Let me get you right back to the very, very beginnings of your paranormal investigation. We'll call it a hobby before it was a career. When you first get into wanting to investigate the paranormal, or even as a hobby, what spurs the initiative? How should I put this? What spurs the love of, or wanting to go out into the field and actually want to do it? There's a difference between sitting at home and going, gosh, you know, it'd be really cool if I could find a ghost, and actually going out there and trying to find some, I guess, evidence of the right. the paranormal. What made you go out there and want to do it?
Absolutely. It was by complete accident. I'd never really watched the paranormal shows. You're talking, this is back in 2005 when mm-hmm. I got into it. I had gotten invited by my mom. She won tickets or got tickets to a place called Fort Delaware here in Delaware where I live. It's a Civil War fort that was a prison camp during the Civil War. And it was a Halloween type paranormal investigation they were doing there. And she had no one to go with her. So my stepsister and myself said, oh, we'll go. I'll go check it out. You know, I was always into the Halloween thing. I'm a Halloween baby. I was born November 1st.
Oh, there you
go. Yeah, and my mom's born Halloween, so it's like that was I've always been a lover of that time of year and all the, you know, the ghosts and stuff and the spooky stuff. So I said, what the hell, let's do this. And I went, and long story short, my first time ever on an investigation, it was only like a 2.5 hour, 3 hour investigation at Fort Delaware. I actually witnessed a half body apparition, and I witnessed this apparition, this half body apparition, my first time out. And it was like, I didn't even tell anybody I saw this at the time. What I saw was this gentleman who at first I thought he was a reenactor, mm-hmm. Because this was the Civil War fort. And what I saw was just from the shoulders up, you know, the head and the shoulders, so all you could see, you could not, and that's what really captured me. We were down in the powder mag where they used to keep all the powder magazines and everything. And I saw this man standing in the hallway away from the group that I was in. There were only five or six of us in this group. You had the kind of the investigator guy who was there leading us around and showing us the location. And I looked to my right over my shoulders, and I see this person standing there, and what caught my eyes was he had no lower half to his body. Mm-hmm. There was no, you know, lower portion. And I can remember him vividly to this day. He had shoulder length, scraggly, dirty hair, a very disheveled beard. And it had, and what I really stuck out to me, had debris in it, like leaves and just dirt in his beard. And he was there maybe 8 to 10 seconds, and he kind of, it sucked into like a ball, like almost, and just kind of disappeared. And all I knew from that night on, like when I left there, and even though I didn't tell anybody, cause I thought they're going to think I was crazy or I was making it up, that some way, somehow I wanted to recreate that or figure out what I saw. And yeah. That started my passion.
That is crazy. So you see this apparition, and of course now you want more. Now I'm going to ask you a crucial question here, Daryl. What gets you to go out a second time? This is the thing. I mean, you see it the first time, you've got that passion to want to create it and do it again. This is always the crucial second step when you want to do it again. How do you figure out how to go out and have a second experience?
Well, I mean, you got to remember too, back in 2005, internet was not really big at the time. There was none of the social media where you could actually, you know, kind of research things. So it was me hitting the bookstores like Barnes and Noble and places like that to find paranormal books and read up on them and try to learn it. I knew nothing about being a ghost hunter. I didn't even know what a ghost hunter was or a paranormal investigator at the time. And I learned, you know, by just jumping in there and learning, you know, and buying, you know, things off online, pieces of equipment that I saw on TV shows. And, you know, of course, some work, some don't work. At least you think they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you start using this equipment. And really, I went out on my own. And then a year or two later is when I met my wife. I was dating her at the time. Okay. And she had never done it before. And she'd been watching the shows. And I said, well, let's do this. And so we started going around to places like Gettysburg and places around Delaware. Fort Delaware, went back a dozen times. And we over the years, we captured so many cool things, you know, just basically little vacations for us. You know, we take the weekend and go. and investigate. And it was just us and a couple pieces of equipment, you know, recorders and things of that nature, or whatever was out at the time. And it grew from there. And I started my own team in 2011 called Breaking Paranormal. And I had hooked up with some people up in Ohio. And geographically speaking, people, I'm from Delaware, Ohio. That's 8 hours, 9 hours away. So It was like us meeting in the middle and finding these locations and kind of, offering up places that we've all been. And that's how I actually got introduced to the House of Wills from the people in Ohio, my investigators. Yeah.
I want to get into the House of the Wills here in a few moments, but I'm really curious, and bear with me here, Daryl, when I ask you this. Between, like, say, 2005, 2006, when you're with your wife, and you're just kind of, and I want to talk about Gettysburg here in a second, too. When you're going to Gettysburg and even back to Fort Delaware, what kind of equipment are you, when you say little pieces of equipment, what are you using? I mean, you said recorders, but are you using a K2? What kind of little pieces of equipment are you picking up?
It's funny you say K2, because that was my first piece of equipment. My wife had actually bought me one for my birthday. Mm-hmm. It was like, that was like big back then, the K2. We were using K2s. We started getting into like the spirit boxes, the original versions, like the hack shacks and stuff like that. Yep. We were using. So it was things of that nature. It was nothing high tech back then. It was, of course, but We were using a lot of that type stuff, REM pods, things of that nature. Yeah.
Okay. Were you hacking your own shack hacks?
No, I wasn't that good at it. Okay. I was buying them off of websites and stuff. Like Ghost of Augustine and things of that nature. Yeah,
because back in 2006, 2007, we were doing the trips with Jay and Grant. We had gone to the Stanley Hotel and we had Bill Chappell with us, and he was telling us how to hack the Radio Shack. Radios. So we went to all the Radio Shacks within, I think it was like a 50-mile vicinity of the Stanley Hotel, and we scooped up all the Radio Shack radios that had the tuners, the digital tuners, and we were pulling the pins on all of them, and then we were selling them as cheap as we could to the people at the conference. And just saying, here, if you want a shack hack, here you go. So people had it. So they had the experience. We were actually blessed enough to have a Frank's box the first few times we were at the Stanley.
Very cool.
Because Chris Moon had come by and he had a Frank's box. But we had some of the weirdest experiences with the Frank's box you could ever imagine. I mean, that's for stories for another day. I'm just curious because, in those days people think, you've always had this great equipment, that you could use back in those days. And it really wasn't, it was really the Wild West of equipment, back in anywhere from 2005 to 2008, 2009,
right.
You were really dealing with very little as far as technology went. So I was just kind of curious what it was you were using when you were out there in the wild, so to speak, and gathering evidence.
Yeah, it was like, it's funny you say it was the Wild West. It's like a gunfighter back in the 1800s with his revolver compared to now with everybody full auto weapons and automatic weapons.
Yes.
It's a big jump. It really is compared to what was. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you watch the shows now and you're right. It's like you're bringing out a full arsenal with everything. And you go, wow, wish I would have had half that stuff when I was out there. So,
well, I think that makes it like, it made it so much fun back then. Cause you just didn't know, it's you're delving into the unknown, and you still are at a point, but back then it was like you said, the Wild West. And it's like, it was fun. It was a really good time. It really was.
Yeah, most definitely. I want to talk to you a little bit about Gettysburg before we move on. I know you had a lot of fun in Gettysburg gathering things. What were some of your favorite spots in Gettysburg to go to?
Oh, wow. My go-to in Gettysburg is the Cashtown Inn, which is really about 9 miles outside of Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. It's actually where the battle first shots were during the Battle of Gettysburg. And the Cashtown Inn is just one of these places. It's like a wealth of knowledge. It's a wealth of history. And it, I've gotten so much great evidence out of that building. I've seen it on the original Ghost Hunters. That's what really drew me to it. And we had some amazing experiences, better than what they ever called in the show there, to be honest with you, in that actual location. And then again, the battlefield. If you can get out there at night, you know, before they close it down around 10 o'clock. I've got some amazing like EVPs out there. We've seen some stuff that you just can't wrap your head around. Gettysburg is just one of those places that every time I go back, and I'm relatively close. I'm about 2 hours from Gettysburg.
Okay.
And I try to get there at least once a year. Matter of fact, I'll be there this October and for an event. But it's one of those places, every time you go back, you find something new, a new location, new spot you've never been. And I've been going for 15 years now.
Yeah.
And I just, it's a must do for paranormal investigators.
Absolutely. I've been there a handful of times, and every time I go there, there's something new, something exciting. And the history is so rich. It's just,
yeah.
It's exciting. It's tragic at the same time, but it's always something that, you know, especially if you're a budding investigator, you have to, it's a must do, you know, because there's so many things you can find both indoors and outdoors. You know, it's one of those places that, you know, whether it's a covered bridge or if it's a battlefield or you go indoors into a house, you're going to pick up something. So, yeah.
I always joke around people and they always ask me, people have never been to Gettysburg and they ask me, like, how was Gettysburg? I said, Gettysburg is one of those places you can get evidence in a porta potty on the battlefield.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those locations. It's so rich in just history and the paranormal on top of it. And it's just like, it's an amazing location and you fall in love with it. Like, it's just this little town that's stuck in time. It's got some modern technology there, don't get me wrong, but it's this town that's stuck in time, and the food is amazing, the locations, the people are amazing, and there's always so much to do there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love Gettysburg and looking forward to getting back there again sometime soon. So, Daryl, here's where we're going to kind of make that transition. We're talking, of course, about the new book, which is available on September 8th, The Horrors of the House of Wills, a true story of a paranormal investigator's most terrifying case. Again, you can pre-order right now on Amazon. We have a link in the description of this podcast. Okay, so now we've moved along. You're, of course, now with your wife, you're starting to gather this group or this loose group of friends, and you're starting to get together on a regular basis and you're investigating. Now you get a suggestion from whom about this spot in Cleveland that you've heard about?
Well, it's funny because I actually got this location when I was investigating Gettysburg with a friend of mine, Greg Knepp, who was part of my team, him and Stephanie. They're both from Akron, Ohio, which is, you know, geographically speaking, it's about half hour outside of Cleveland. And they were like, hey, we investigated this location called the House of Wills. And then they're going, this is 3 o'clock in the morning, they're going on about it. And I'm like, there's no way. Like, all this stuff is happening there. I'm thinking they're over exaggerating. And like, some of the things they were telling me was crazy. And I'm like, okay, whatever, let's do it. So literally about 3 or 4 weeks later, next thing I know, I'm traveling to the House of Wills. And the weird thing about it, and I wrote this in the book, was I started having dreams of this location. And I don't know, it could have been just what I've been told, but I knew what this location looked like before I was even in the building. Okay. Like, I was having these really vivid dreams of it. And weird things started right before, maybe a few days before I left, weird things started happening around my house. My dog started acting weird, hearing things, seeing things, which I've never had before.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like a buildup to it. It was either something telling me not to go. At the time, like I said, I wasn't as mature as I am now as an investigator, but I went, and I tell you, I was not physically or mentally prepared for what I was walking into. None of us were. And we got to this location, and it's the only location. It's how I explain it to people is it's the only place I've ever been. I've been to some crazy locations over the years. It's the only place I've ever been that it doesn't feel like so much it's haunted by just spirits, but the location itself is a living organism.
Okay.
And the only way I can explain that is when you walk in there, there's such an energy. And I don't know if it's the way the building was designed. It was designed by a Masonic architect back in the 1800s, a 32nd degree Mason. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the way he designed the building, but this energy in this building it's overwhelming. And that's what they kept telling me. Everyone kept telling me, and I'd spoken to other people too before I went, like, you'd been there, and like, you're going to feel things there and see things there that you're not going to believe. The energy is just intense, and the energy is so strong in that building. Like, you literally have to, every 45 minutes to an hour, walk outside and ground yourself and just get it off of you. It's the only place I've ever been to like that, where you can't stand being in it too long. It's too much.
You know, something interesting, you have the plans of the actual House of Wills in the book.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to point out here, first of all, I'll point this out, and then I have another question for you on top of that has to do with the actual energy of the building and the fact that you were having actual dreams about it, not dreams about it, but visions of it. We can call it dreams or visions or whatever before you went there, and things happening before you went there. If you look at the plans of the actual House of Wills, it's eerie. And I meant to bring this up to you. I didn't know if I was going to do this off air or on air, but since you mentioned it on air, I want to bring it up to you. If you know anything about King Solomon's palace, or King Solomon's, where King Solomon resided, and you know anything about Masonic lore,
mm-hmm.
It looks a little bit, when you look at the plans, like King Solomon's, where King Solomon resided.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that the higher and lower keys of Solomon and things of that nature, that's what really, like, this location is what really started me to really investigate more into the higher and lower keys of Solomon and things of that nature, because of that location, you know, sigils and things of that nature. So I understand exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So as you had mentioned that, you know, it was built by a Mason in the book, and when you included the plans, I started to look at the plans, and I went, well, you know, and the fact that there were other things included, including an Egyptian room, and you had mentioned that the mm-hmm. owner, the current owner, had certain things in there that we'll get to later in the story here. I started to go, okay. And I started to put some things together that we'll talk about again later in the show. But you said you had started to have these visions before you even went. And I wonder, I want to bring up a theory here, because I want to know where you sit with this. I know there are certain investigators that don't want to bring up the D word or demon.
Right.
Adam Bly, who's a demonologist, I don't know if you've ever had dealings with him or talked with him, will say that a demon will leave a calling card for you before you even have any dealings with them. A lot of times it'll be an appearance. They'll leave a vision for you. They'll do something to let you know, or that you're about to cross them before you even cross them.
Right.
With that in mind, in hindsight, because hindsight's always 20/20, I know what your theory is on this, and you've stated what your theory is about this haunting in the book. And again, we'll talk about that a little later. With that in mind, do you believe that we can speak the D word when it comes to this particular haunting? At least partially.
Partially, yes. I don't know if that's what I was dealing with there, or any of us were dealing with. I do think there is a very dark, dark energy there. And, you know, my teachings and learnings about, you know, about demons and things of that nature is usually you don't know you've crossed one until it's too late. It's not like they show themselves to your face right away. Mm-hmm. They're very patient and they like, you know, playing havoc on your life and destroying your life. And in a lot of cases, that's what kind of happened. And, you know, after I left there, mm-hmm. I was having these things happen in my house that I had to get, you know, I basically had to reach out to people in the field that knew what they were doing and dealing with these types of entities or, you know, hauntings to help me get rid of it. And truthfully, the only thing that helped me get rid of it out of all the things that people were throwing at me was I found God.
Yeah.
And I found God really quick.
Yeah.
And that's what helped me. I'm not embarrassed to say that at all. And I tell you, that's the only thing that helped me. That's the only thing that made me feel better. And that's the only thing that got rid of what was in my house.
Absolutely.
I can say that.
Absolutely.
I can say that. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, Daryl, let's take our break right here. And I really want to jump into the meat of the story here because it is chilling. That's the only way to put it is the House of Wills is a place unlike any other. You know, we talk about some of the most chilling places on earth. You could talk about Waverly Hills Sanatorium all you want. You could talk about Devil's Den in Gettysburg. You can talk about any of the places you want to talk about worldwide that could absolutely send chills up your spine. But the fact of the matter is when you read about this particular place, I think this place, the House of Wills, will absolutely astound you. And I know you're going to have a lot of people after they read this book that are going to want to go there. I'm going to ask you this before we go to break, Daryl. What would be your advice to the people who read this and go, even for a thrill, go, I want to go to this place? What would be your advice?
If you do decide to go to this location, which I can't stop anybody, I don't want to say don't go. But what I want to say to people is if you go to this location, go there as a complete observer. Do not taunt. Do not open yourself up to it. And I believe I said this in the book. If you go there, don't have any baggage in your life. And what I mean by that is if you're having any kind of marital, financial, health problems, anything, don't go because it feeds off of that. And I've seen it do it, not just to myself, but to friends of mine, to other investigators and people who have went there. Do not go because that type of energy, not just the House of Wills, but any type of dark energy at these locations will feed off of your problems in your life. If it's a true, you know, if it's a true dark spirit of some sort, demon, whatever you want to call it, it will pick up on that and it will use it against you. That's all I have to say about that. Yep.
Okay. The Horrors of the House of Wills, a true story of a paranormal investigator's most terrifying case. It's available right now for pre-order. Book comes out on September 8th. I suggest you pre-order this book right now. Get it. Get it and get it now. We've got a link in the description of this program. When we come back, more with Daryl Marston. We'll talk about the House of Wills, the extremely chilling experience the minute he came up to the door of the House of Wills. What he found inside just walking around will terrify you. We'll talk about that when we come back next on the Best in Paranormal Programming. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Our guest is Daryl Marston, paranormal investigator, co-lead investigator of A&E's Ghost Hunters, and the author of The Horrors of the House of Wills, a true story of a paranormal investigator's most terrifying case. It is up for pre-order right now. We've got a link in the description of this program. Book comes out on September 8th. It's available by Llewellyn Press. Daryl, before the break, we teased that we're about to enter the House of Wills. I want to set the scene for our audience real quick. So you're you're driving up to the building. You're getting up to the building here with your friends. It's been a long drive. And you're about to get there. You've had these visions of what this place looks like. You've already got some trepidation. You've had some stuff happen at the house. The dog has obviously been warning you. Mm-hmm. You had some other things happening that tell you, you know what, maybe this isn't the best idea. You get to the House of Will. Set the scene for me. What is the neighborhood like? What is the actual building like? What are you feeling before you even step foot into the House of Wills?
What I could tell you is, and this is not a knock on East Cleveland at all. East Cleveland is a beautiful place, but there's some areas, neighborhoods that are not the best areas. And the House of Wills just happens to be right in the heart of all that, with drive-by shootings and things of that nature. So that's something else people have to think when they go there. I mean, once you're on the property, you're pretty safe because they don't want anything to do with the property. And that's the neighborhood. That's one thing we were told before we got there, that people avoid the building. And you know, you're thinking, okay, people were exaggerating, whatever. We get there and we have some time before the caretaker shows up to let us in. And a gentleman named George at the time. And he as we're waiting outside, I walk up to the sidewalk and I notice that people maybe a half a block away, instead of walking in front of the building, they actually are crossing the street, getting on the opposite side of the street, and then walking past the building, which I'm like, this is real. People are actually doing this. I sat there and watched 10 people do it over like a maybe 15 minute period of time. I never seen one person walk in front of the building. From what I was told, that people are afraid of the location and they do believe that there are certain people in that neighborhood of East Cleveland that believe that all the bad doings or the decline in the society around there is due to the House of Wills, that it is has drawn in so much dark energy in the neighborhood that the drive-by shootings, the drug abuse, the drug dealing and things of that nature are all a byproduct of the House of Wills. There are people who believe that in the community. And I wrote about most of that in the book, what I was allowed to put it that way. And that's one of the things I noticed. And finally, when the caretaker showed up, one of the first things he said to us before you start your investigation, now it's still daytime out. This is July. So it's about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, I believe. And so it's still a little daylight. He said, we have to clear the building. And I'm like thinking to myself, I was a firearms instructor, so I know what clearing means. And I'm just making sure he's saying what I think he's saying.
Yeah.
Clear the building. And I'm like, clear the building? Do you mean like clear the building of people? And he said, yeah, there could be a possibility. There could be people inside. We don't know. So I'm like, okay. And I always, you know, I have a concealed carry and I always carry it. And a couple of the guys on the team also concealed carry. So yeah, we went in and took about a good hour. The place is when you look at it in a picture, pictures don't do it justice. It's huge. I mean, it's a maze inside. It's room upon room upon room, rooms inside of rooms. So it took a good hour to clear the entire location to make sure there was nobody in there. But there was a story that's in the book that one of the caretakers was attacked by a guy with an axe. True story. She was there by herself. She showed up and went in the building one day, and there was a guy waiting at the top of the stairs, just standing there with an axe. And she took off, and thank God he was not able to catch up with her. And she got out of the building, was able to get to her vehicle where she had her handgun, and pulled it out. And when she turned around, he was no longer there. You know, she called the police. The police showed up. They swept the building. They couldn't find the guy, but all they could find was the actual axe sitting, I believe it was sitting next to the stage area in the auditorium. So there's stories of that. There's true stories about that. That actually really happened. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So what is it about this place? What's the history of this place, Gerald, that makes it so bad that the locals don't even want to cross in front of it. They'll cross cross the street around it. That makes this place so bad. What is it about this place that's so bad?
Good question. I mean, it started out, like I said, it was an architect who's a 32nd degree Mason. It's all in the book. He designed the location back in. See, the crazy thing is that the records are really hard on this place to find exactly when it was built. We do know it was definitely built around 1890. I mean, 1850 and 1890. There's parts of the building they're saying are from the 1850s. But so we'll say 1890. The architect comes in there. He's a 32nd degree Mason. The Masonic Temple of Cleveland, Ohio area. Really well known Mason in that area. He built this location. Many locations in Cleveland are still standing to this very day. And so after it was a Masonic Temple, it became a German social club for many years during around World War I. So you have that. Then it became a hospital for several years. I believe it was a Hebrew hospital. It was rumored to be a speakeasy. I could never find any actual evidence of that. But if it was truly a speakeasy that was never found out by the federal government, there would be no record of it anyway. Mm-hmm. So you have that. And then in around 1945, it became Cleveland's largest African-American funeral home and mortuary.
Mm.
And so you got these layers of all this stuff going on. And it stayed that way all the way up till the early 2000s. Now, the original owner, Mr. Wills, he passed away in 1971. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got the name, the House of Wills. He passed away and he left it to his children who ran the location, and it declined over the years and all the way up to the early 2000s, where there was some, not so much tomfoolery, but there was there's some fraud and things of that nature going on, and the place got shut down, and some people did get arrested and went to prison. So it sat for about 10 years from, like, I'm going to say 2002 to 2012, where a gentleman by the name of Eric Freeman bought the property. He built, and I've talked to Eric several times. I've had meetings with him. And I actually had to get his permission to write the book because he is the owner of the property right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric Freeman, and this is not, this is all public knowledge. He is a high ranking priest in the new Church of Satan.
Okay.
So he purchased this property. He brought his beliefs there. And I'm not knocking his beliefs. Everybody's allowed to believe what they want to.
Sure.
He's a businessman. I've spoken to him. He doesn't push his beliefs on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing I respect about him. He does what he does, and that's it. But so you're bringing this dark energy of the, he has done rituals in the building.
Okay.
So you got that layered on top of everything. There have been murders there. There have been all kinds of rumored, sexual assaults, things of that stuff in the building, not by him.
Right.
This is before him.
Right.
So you have all these different layers of this good and bad over the years, just layered on top of each other. And then you introduce a gentleman like Eric Freeman who brings his beliefs into the building. That's why I think this place is so scary to the community around it. They're not used to that. They're not used to having basically a high ranking or high priest of the new Church of Satan or running a building in the middle of their neighborhood. And I think rumors fly like they do, and they get pushed around, and people think that's probably why the place is so dark in energy and haunted. And it very well could be some of that. Who knows what is brought into that building? What I saw with my own eyes with the statues and things of that nature that were in the building when I was there that are no longer there because they were actually burnt about 7 or 8 years ago in a fire. They, these people from the community came in there and tried to burn the property down with Eric in the building, and his girlfriend.
Yikes.
Yeah.
That's scary in itself.
Yeah.
You know what? I might change my thought here for a moment. Bear with me here, and then I want to get back to the subject at hand, which is what you saw when you first walked in the building. So I said, do you think there was a demon involved showing you or making its calling card when you had these visions? I'm going to change my thought now here, Daryl, and that's this. When you brought up the subject of God, now I'll bring up maybe a guardian angel. Do you think maybe an angel shows you the visions of what's coming because of the dark energy that's there at that building? Do you think maybe it was a warning?
Yeah, absolutely. Quite possibly. Yeah, I do. And I still think to this day that, you know, one of the reasons I did write the book was not just for my own well-being, but to put out there what these type of locations can do to people and how dangerous they can be. I think sometimes people take the paranormal as just fun, and it can be, believe me, it can be. But there are certain locations out there that probably should not be dealt with or taken that they're just a regular haunting, because they're not. This place is not like any place in the 400 plus locations I've done. None of them stack up to this. None of them. Close. Yeah. None.
So you clear the building and it's time to, I mean, obviously you've seen some stuff as you're clearing the building, but it's time to step in and actually do the investigation. You've been looking for people. Now you're actually getting a good look at what's inside. What is it that you're seeing inside that is absolutely startling you?
The first thing would be the statues. That was the one thing that really blew my mind. In the auditorium area, the first statues that we come across, and I was told about these, but I didn't know what to expect when I saw them, were these three or four very large, 7 to 8 foot tall wooden hand carved statues of. The one that really stands out to me was looked like some kind of medieval torture device. It had chains on it. It had straps on it, like a pendulum type. And I don't know how to say this. Hand carved wooden phallus, okay. About 15 inches long, on a pendulum.
Okay.
And there would be a place where someone was strapped. Very dark. It just, the energy off of these things, just like, wow. And I know art is, you know, it's taken, you know, whoever the artist was. And from what I'm told, Eric was the artist of these actual statues. He actually hand carved them himself. From what I was told, I never really asked him about it. And someday I will. But that's what I first came across. And then in some of the other rooms, like the Egyptian room, there was a statue of and I'm trying to create this in my head again. It was if you would take a human body and cut it straight down the center and show the integrals and everything, that was on an upside down cross. There was several of these type of statues throughout the building in different rooms. One was on the stage area. There's another one up in the loft area, which was a large, studio sized apartment type room that was upside down cross. And it looked like what could have been an upside down angel. It was upside down cross, basically a rosary with a decapitated Jesus on it. Yeah, there was these types of statues and things were strewn throughout the building.
Wow. Shocking, to say the least. That's for sure.
Yes.
That's for sure. So immediately your senses are overwhelmed. You're already overwhelmed as you walk in.
Yeah.
So you've got to get it together, obviously, because you've got other things that you're going to be looking for supernaturally. What do you do to center yourself at this point to start looking for other things?
That's the problem. I didn't center myself. And I think that's why I left myself open to it. I was like running, gunning, trying to get this investigation going because I knew I'd basically had about 15, 16 hours before I had to turn right back around and hit the road again. So I don't think I even took time to center myself at that point. It was like a lot of like, hey, let's get set up. And, you know, we were setting cameras up everywhere. I think we had like a total of 10 or 12 static cams throughout the building. We had, you know, a base camp with monitors and things of that nature. And that took several hours to at least 2 hours to set up all that. So the one thing we did do, we had a meeting outside right before it got dark. And I'll never forget this. And this is one of the craziest things to me because I never had a vision like this before, where we were having this meeting. There was four of us there, including myself, and where we kind of stood in a circle and Stephanie wanted to say a prayer. And I'm mm-hmm. like, okay, I'm like kind of rolling my eyes at the time, like, whatever, let's do this. And we said, yeah, she said a prayer. And during this prayer, I had this crazy visual one. I'm not even saying a vision. Like it felt so real in the moment where we're saying the prayer and all I can remember in my head was laughing. And I visioned myself pulling my firearm on these three people. Crazy thing is, when we were walking away, I stopped Keith, who was the investigator who came with me from Delaware. And I said, man, I just had this crazy vision. He said, stop right there. He said, let me tell you, I had a vision too. And he explained to me the exact same vision that I had, that he had. Same thing. Right then and there, it was like, okay, this something's not right. Something is not right here at all.
Yeah.
And then we entered the building. It was like we made an oath to everybody. No one goes anywhere in that building by themselves. I don't care if it's in a bathroom or whatever. You do not go anywhere by yourself. Everyone needs to be together.
Very good idea. And yeah, you know, I got to ask you this question, Daryl. At this point, when you realize, when you and Keith are talking to each other that there's something messing with you, at this point, it's malevolent. You have to know it's malevolent.
Right.
Is there a thought at this point that maybe you need to go in with someone who's, I don't want to say clergy, but someone who's related to clergy, maybe someone who's, and at that point, are you offending Eric if you come in with somebody who's clergy, someone who's not of his beliefs?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we really, honestly, yeah, if I had someone who was part of the clergy nearby, yeah, I would have definitely brought them with me. At that point, I don't care who I was, you know, offending, but truthfully, didn't have the time. Wasn't really thinking like that. We were just thinking, I never thought that I would have something follow me home. And that was the kicker. And I wish that I would have thought this case out better. I wish this was a case that I would have taken on like now, mm-hmm. where I'm more mature and I know better. But unfortunately I didn't. And that's probably why this book is, you know, it's so good to so many people because it happened, man. It shows that I don't care who you are and how good you think you are. You're very vulnerable to this type of haunting or this type of, you know, entity.
You know, Stephanie was the one, it seems like, in this entire scenario who was thinking ahead of time. She actually brought Sage to the investigation.
Yeah,
didn't she?
Yeah, she did. Yep. And at that point, I've never even used Sage. I knew what it was, but I never had used it. She used it on us toward the end of the night. And she actually gave me some to take home with me. And when I was having the things happen in my house, I started using it, and it helped for a little bit, but it wasn't the end all be all, but it did help.
Sure. Sure. And we're going to leave some of this for the book for people to read. I do want to, cause there's some other things that happened to you at home, and I want people to read about those things inside the book, Daryl, because
sure.
Again, there's some, And I think it's safe to say that there are some things that are absolutely chilling that happened to you in your story that I want these people to follow up and get from the book. I want to move on to how tragedy becomes fortune and misfortune becomes fortune. I want to move on to how this investigation game goes from being a hobby to a profession. How is it that paranormal investigation goes from just being an everyday hobby to you ending up on A&E's Ghost Hunters?
Oh, wow. luck. I'll tell you, it's crazy because I never really wanted to be on a TV show or anything like that. I never really thought about it. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I used to, and on my show, the American Ghost Hunter show, which I mean, I haven't done that show in almost 6 years now. It started out, you know, a small little podcast on YouTube, and it grew over a 3 or 4 year period. It got pretty big. And that's where they actually found me, the producers and people from Pilgrim who, you know, produced Ghost Hunters. Mm-hmm. They saw someone, you know, I don't know, it came across someone's desk. And that's how they found me. And I remember getting a phone call one night, you know, from a number I didn't know out of Burbank, California. And I'm like, who the hell is this? You know, and I didn't even answer it. I let it go to voicemail. And they left a message. And then next thing I know, we're playing phone tag back and forth. And next thing I know, I'm flying to L.A. and signing contracts. And a couple weeks later, hitting the road hard and filming, man, it was crazy. It happened so fast. It was such a blur. It really was.
What's the difference between an investigation on television and one that you do yourself?
Wow. I've been asked this before. I tell you, investigating on TV, I mean, investigating for yourself, basically, you know, you're running a location or you got a location you're going to for a night. And you know, you pack up at the end of the night and you go home. Well, on TV, you're there for anywhere from 5 to 10, sometimes 14 days on one location. And that's, you know, that's how we feel. I can't speak for the other shows, but that's how we filmed. Mm-hmm. And you know, it would be from going from filming, say, in Texas this week, and then you're jumping on you get one day off, and then you're jumping on a plane on a Sunday and you're flying to Alaska. And then you're flying to, say, Mississippi. It was very run and gun, and you lived out of a suitcase. Yeah, crazy, crazy. And you're like, it's a lot of, also on set, it's a lot of hurry up and wait. You get there, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon when the sun's still up. You're prepping, you're doing interviews and things of that nature. And then when the sun goes down, it's run and gun to investigate for, you know, hour 15 at a time. And you might do, you know, in one night, 3, 4, 5 runs, meaning that you're going to investigate different parts of the location 4 or 5 times.
Very interesting. Let me ask you this. You know, when you're on your own, you, of course, you pick your teammates. You have the people that you have chemistry with that you go out and you investigate with. When it comes to television, you don't get to pick your castmates or you don't get to pick your team.
No. How,
do you find chemistry within the group? Do they put you together with someone and you have to make chemistry? How does that work?
Well, in the very beginning, when we first started filming, I was put with, it was me and Grant, and then it flipped over to, it was me and Kristen, who were co-lead investigators with Grant, and we kind of flipped back and forth with him for investigating. And then the second season I picked up Mustafa. And it was me and Mustafa investigating because we had a really good chemistry off screen too. Mm-hmm. You know, me, Mustafa and Brandon, you know, came really close friends off screen. And, you know, we would always travel together when possible. And, yeah, it was just like, they see that, you know, especially mm-hmm. the executive producers, they see that and they see, you know, your style and the way you joke and things of that nature and how you come off on screen together. And that's a big part of it. Yeah.
When you get to learn different things about different people, do you find that especially among your castmates, when it comes to paranormal experiences, are you finding that a lot of them are the same, that they're different, that when you spoke to your castmates about the House of Wills, did you find in your experiences with it and the haunting, did you find that they had similar haunting experiences?
Somewhat, but not to that extent. None of them really had things that followed them home and things of that nature. It was funny because one of the first day or two I was on set, I was doing a what's called hero shots, and the DP, director of photography, Kendall Welpton, was actually doing these, you know, hero shots of me for the A&E series. And he's kind of just making small talk with me. He's laying on the ground doing these shots of me standing there in front of the St. Augustine Lighthouse. And he's like, just small talk. Hey, so what's the craziest place you've ever been? And I say, well, truthfully, the craziest place I've ever been is this place called the House of Wills in Cleveland. Not thinking he'd ever been there. Mm-hmm. He literally jumped up. He's like, did you say House of Wills? I said, yeah, yeah. I said, why? He's like, dude, I've been there. I was like, what do you mean you've been there? He said, I filmed there with Ghost Brothers. And he said, I'll never go back to that damn place. Or he didn't say damn. He said effing. Mm-hmm. He said, I'll never go back to that effing place. And then one of our producers, this big guy named Russ, he was one of the field producers. He kind of tuned in and heard it. And he's like, do you say House of Wills? I'm like, yeah. He's like, and then it's all of a sudden, because he was there with Kendall filming because they filmed Ghost Brothers there. And he's like, man, dude, no effing way will I ever go back. And like, then this started this camaraderie, you know, people yeah. who've been to the House of Wills, and like, we know what it's about. And we were just swapping stories, like how insane that place is. As a matter of fact, it's crazy because we were filming in Ohio, and we were saying, crazy story is, we had to go film at Madison Seminary in Ohio. Thing was, it was, they were doing the Major League Baseball like thing there, where it was like, yeah, you know, the series, and there was no hotels, so they had to put us inside Cleveland, which is like almost an hour away from Madison. Mm-hmm. And so we're literally staying maybe 10, 12 blocks away from the House of Wills and the hotel. Ooh. And we were like, and one day we had off, like, guys, let's go. Like, no one would go. Like, they're like, nope. They had no effing way we're going there. I said, come on, I can get us in. They're like, no, no. They kept saying, yeah, maybe, maybe. And then, like, they all would just back out. Like, nope, ain't going, man. Can't do it. Can't do it again. I'm like, I get you. it was crazy.
So if you would, let's just play a what if here. If you would have gone with the two guys over there, would you have filmed it? Would you have done some B-roll and maybe used it on a show in a future episode?
I was talking, you know, with production about trying to do something there, and in hopes it would come around, and it never did. Yeah. It was just one of those things, man. Yeah. I think we would have went there and filmed some stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. That would have been something. I mean, it's too bad that it didn't happen, but you know, when you read the book and you really get into the book, would you mentally have been in that place that you could have done it? To me, it seems like you really would have had to force yourself to go in there. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, no, you're 100% correct. I think I was more on adrenaline at that moment. And I was like, if they did it, I would do it type thing. Yeah, like, hey, you know, if you jump in, I'll jump in. Yeah, yeah. See who does it first, you know. And I was like, and like, yeah, I didn't, honestly, in the back of my head, I did not want to go. No, but I couldn't, you know, I couldn't say no. If one of them said, okay, let's do it, you know, I'm like, no, let's do it, you know. I don't know. It's just one of those things at the time. You're just like, let's do it, because you're right there. But it's crazy, because I'll be back in, I have a book signing in Cleveland October 13th, and we'll see what happens, you know.
Now, you did mention in the book that you thought that this time of year, right around fall of 2023, that you'd be filming a project in that area.
Actually, that was supposed to happen last year. We were working with a production company, and that all kind of fell through. But we'll see what happens, man. You know, who knows?
Okay, so the book signing comes up in fall in Cleveland. Are you of a mind or even of a spiritual sense that you think that if someone were to say, even if you were to get a call from a paranormal team, and they were to say, "Oh, come on, Daryl, we're willing to do it. In fact, we even have someone of the clergy who will come with that will be there that can help." Would you be of a mind to do it again?
I think I am of a mind to do it again, but do I want to put myself through that and be like, in joking around, I'd be like, show me the money. Show me the money, because this time I'm getting paid to go through that shit.
Okay, so let's take it one tier higher, okay?
Yeah.
Documentary for money.
Yeah.
Okay, would you be willing to do a documentary?
Yeah, I think it would be different because you'd be, I've been there. I know it. I know what it's capable of, and I think I can handle it, definitely. I'm very protected these days by, you know, what I've put around me, this energy around me, not like I was almost 10 years ago when I was there the first time.
Okay.
I would just be, my concern would be for the people who are with me.
Okay.
That would be my main concern, keeping an eye on them. Because, you know, you could tell people all you want till you're blue in the face, and they might not take it seriously. Some might, some may not. And, you know, to keep in themselves, you know, protected. And like I said, man, don't bring baggage in there, because it's going to feed off of it. Like I said, you know, financial, health, marital, don't bring it there. If you're having problems at home, do not go there.
Yeah.
Because that negative energy will feed off of that.
I'm just thinking, now hear me out here, because sometimes I'm a bit of a mad scientist when it comes to ideas. If you could grab somebody like Grant Mustafa, and you could bring in someone who's a seasoned, let's just say a seasoned demonologist like John Zaffis, who has a tie to, you know, a family such as that, or someone who is related like that, a demonologist who would come in, who would be available. And there were a production company behind it that would be willing to, you know, put up cash. I'm just saying, would that be enough of a comfort level, and especially with cash behind it, that would make you jump?
Yeah, I mean, it would definitely, you put an A-list team together, like what you just spoke of, you know, Zaffis, Grant, Mustafa, people like that, who I feel comfortable working with. And I know everyone will have each other's back and know what to do if a situation did, you know, go south. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, not to knock my team that I was there with before, never. But I think we were all a little bit immature at the time to be going to such a crazy place that we had no business being in.
Okay. Again, just playing hypotheticals. That's all.
Yes. Yeah. But, yeah, I get it.
But, you know, it speaks a lot to the people you have beside you and your mindset, where you are spiritually, things like that, and whether you would want to even relive that. And of course there's a dollar sign there that would talk as well. And for people that say a dollar sign, come on, Tim, why would you talk about money? Because money, again, is energy exchanged. People don't realize there's an energy exchange with money as well. There is a price to what you will go and do. And it is a wear on your soul a little bit to go in and try and experience some of this stuff again, especially in the name of entertainment. Let's face it.
Yeah.
If you're going to put yourself through something, there has to be some energy exchanges. If I'm going to put this energy out, some energy has to come back in. And that's essentially what money is. It's some sort of energy exchange in order to do something. I want people to understand that as well. Speaking of the difference between amateur and professional, let's talk about that for a second, because you put something brilliantly in the book, and I've argued this for years, and you put this so brilliantly, Daryl, in the book, the difference between ghost hunter and paranormal investigator, and you separate it so wonderfully. I tried to put it in a different term, and I think somebody might have got offended by it because they emailed me and they said, "How dare you?" I tried to say hobbyist, and I forget what the other word was. I used hobbyist, and they hated the fact that I used hobbyist. But you put it brilliantly by saying ghost hunter and professional and paranormal investigator. Tell me the difference between ghost hunter and paranormal investigator and why your term is better than mine of hobbyist.
I mean, if I can remember correctly what I put in the book, but I mean, I'll try to explain it to you without offending anybody, hopefully. A ghost hunter to me, and it's crazy because, you know, the show is called Ghost Hunters that I was on. But a ghost hunter is someone who does this as maybe a, not so much a thrill seeker, but they just go to have fun. They want to go investigate, not be bothered by all the scientific terms and be weighed down by something like that. And it's all about having fun. It's like a week, you go once a month on the weekend or whatever and do your thing. A paranormal investigator is someone who actually investigates paranormal activity, where they try to prove or disprove a location, an event, a haunting, and they're willing to put in the time. A real paranormal investigator will put in the time. Like, you're talking anywhere from weeks, months, even years to either prove or disprove a haunting. Mm-hmm. Now, that's how I put it. And please correct me if I'm wrong. That's how I put it in the book, but I try to explain it to people.
You did, and you put it brilliantly. And the fact of the matter is, it's okay to be a ghost hunter. You don't have to be an investigator. You don't have to say, "Hey, I'm in it for the science, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to." You know what? You don't have to have the pedigree. If you just want to go out there to find evidence and say, "Hey, look what I got." You know, if you want to be the trophy fisherman, go out there and be the trophy fisherman. That's fine.
Right.
You know, go have fun with it. Nobody is disparaging you if you do it.
I mean, in my opinion, yeah, and this might get a little slack from this, but in my opinion, a ghost hunter also is someone of a thrill seeker. You want to get scared in the moment. You want to go have a good time and get a jump scare or whatever. I'm all for that. Believe me, because I know that fine line, and I'll admit it. I know the fine line between entertainment and being, you know, an investigator, because the entertainment side of it is ghost hunting.
Yeah.
That's what you see on TV.
Yep.
The paranormal investigating side of it, there is no series long enough to film that. That you just can't. I mean, it's like I said, it could take weeks, months, even years to investigate a true paranormal haunting and to prove or disprove and to do the different layers of investigating, where you could try to, you know, connect, you know, from a take it from a pseudoscience to an actual science, which hopefully we see in our lifetime. I don't know if we will or not, because people don't get along enough in this field, unfortunately,
yeah,
where they can all come together and work together and try to prove the, you know, that these paranormal events are real. What I can say is, over the last 5-6 years, I have been seeing a lot more scientists getting into this field and, you know, getting their feet wet, basically, and trying to, you know, investigate and put out equipment to actually try to prove this. I mean, one of the things on our show was, you know, when they gave us the camera for, you know, for filming photon events. Mm-hmm. That was given to us by a scientist loaned to us by a scientist. Yeah, that camera was used by the military and by NASA for 30 some years now.
Yeah,
to collect single photon events. And for us to have it, to be one of the first teams ever on TV to use it and to actually capture, you know, these photon events showing paranormal activity, that's a big thing.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a big thing from the scientific community to actually say, "Hey, you're getting these things. So we're capturing these photon events. We want to see what you could do with them." And that's basically what they did. And it worked.
Yeah.
So that's a step in the right direction. It really is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let's face it, if you did a show about, not a show about ghost hunting, but a show about paranormal investigating, most people would be bored silly because it would be 4 hours in the dark with not a lot going on. You would be bored to tears. Thank God you have the show about ghost hunting. Let's just put it that way, because you're getting what you want on the screen. Daryl, kind of wrapping things up today. What lesson do you want people to come away with reading the ghost or the horrors of the House of Wills, a true story of a paranormal investigator's most terrifying case? What is it that you want people to come away with?
I think what I'm trying to, you know, especially these days, is trying to put out there with the younger investigators or the people who are just starting to investigate, is to educate them in these types of hauntings, and to, you know, really protect themselves. And you don't have to go out there and investigate these type of places. You can go investigate, you know, your Waverly Hills or your Eastern States penitentiaries and be safe. Not to, you know, take anything away from those locations. I've investigated all of them, and had captured amazing evidence, but you don't have to worry about bringing anything home with you. There are these type of locations like the House of Wills, and there are other ones out there that it will follow you home. And I'm not the first person that's followed. Believe me, I'm not special in any type of way when it comes to the House of Wills having things follow people home. It's happened to multiple people over the years. But I think one of the main things I would like to get out to people is to educate the younger investigators or the first timers. Really educate yourself, and not just reading a book like the Horrors of the House of Wills, but really educate yourself on a property, especially if it's got, you know, these darker intentions. And just be safe out there, guys. Really be safe out there and be smart about it.
Right on. The Horrors of the House of Wills, a true story of a paranormal investigator's most terrifying case, is available for pre-order right now. We have a link in the description of this show. It is officially released on September 8th. It's available again by Llewellyn Press. Daryl Marston is the author of that book. Daryl, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
It's been our honor, my friend. Appreciate it. And I wish you much success on the sale of the book.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I want to thank my guest, Daryl Marston, today for joining us on the program. We'll have all his links in the description of this program, including the link to the brand new book, The Horrors of the House of Wills, a true story of a paranormal investigator's most terrifying case. Again, pre-orders are being taken for that book, which is available from Llewellyn Press. That link in the description of the program as well. Get it right now. I'm telling you, folks, you're going to love the book. Absolutely going to love the book. Some very terrifying stories in this book. Some stories that will absolutely just chill you. Some stories that will scare you in this book. Some stories that will just, still when I think of them, they leave hairs up on the back of my neck. They're so chilling. So, yeah, pick up this book, definitely. Yeah, pre-order. Make sure you pre-order so that you have it when it releases on September 8th. Folks, I want to thank our sponsor for the week, Mint Mobile. I'm telling you, my phone bill was $180 a month with Big Wireless. Cut that out. Stop doing that. Get your wallet a lot fatter by signing up for Mint Mobile right now. Just $15 a month right now for unlimited talk, text, and data. You can't beat it, folks. Mint Mobile, take advantage of it right now. Unlimited talk, text, and data. Just $15 a month. The way you do it, you just go to mintmobile.com/darkness. Take advantage of that special right now. They will mail you a SIM card, or you can take advantage of the eSIM option. Either way, you can use your own device, and your contacts will transfer over as well. It's so simple, folks. I'm telling you. And it's just $15 a month right now. Take advantage of it. mintmobile.com/darkness. Do it today. Folks, when you patronize our sponsors, it also helps out our show and helps you to bring this show to you for free. And of course, we love bringing you the show for free. We love to continue to bring you the show for free. And we continue to bring you great guests as well by doing that. Please go out and at least take a look at our sponsors, see what they have to offer. We appreciate it if you would do that for us. Also, we want to ask you to go ahead and take care of yourself and each other. Look in on a neighbor this weekend. as again, that hot streak doesn't want to seem to let up on it. It's got a chokehold on all of us right now as we trudge on through August and get into the later days of August. It doesn't want to let up. So please look out after an elderly neighbor or a neighbor that may be having some sort of a disability that may need you. Just make sure they're staying cool, they're staying hydrated throughout this heat, and that they're doing okay. Also want you to put out your prayers, your thoughts, and healing vibes for the people of Lahaina, the people of Maui. That fire that went through there was just absolutely something, spurred on by hurricane winds. There are disasters that happen all over the world, but I tell you, folks, it was something that I believe it was the police chief, or it was the fire chief, one or the other. I don't remember who it was who said it to NBC News, but he said, when it is man versus nature, nature always wins. And although at the time, in the middle of a disaster, you would think that's a little bit of a harsh comment to say, it's very true. Whenever it is man versus nature, nature always wins. And a lot of times we like to think as a human race that we have the technological know-how, or we always have the answer, or we tend to want to hold our leaders to a higher standard because we do have technology on our side, because we do know better, because we are so advanced. But it's true. When it comes to man versus nature, almost 99.9% of the time, nature is going to win. It's an awesome force. We really are just fleas on the backs of Mother Nature. And eventually she's going to shake and we're going to fall off. Just remember that as you head into the weekend. I know it's a little bit of a gruesome thought, but the fact of the matter is we're fortunate to be on this planet. We're fortunate enough to be sustained on this planet. It's really an attitude of gratitude when you wake up in the morning. Just remember to be grateful for everything that you have around you. And we have so much around us. We really are in a planet of abundance. We have so much. So when you wake up in the morning this weekend, just remember, you're surrounded by so much and love and abundance and great things on this planet. Just take a moment to be thankful for the things that you do have. It's such a wonderful, wonderful existence. I'm grateful for you guys. So I'm going to say before I sign off here, thank you so much for continuing to listen to this product. Thank you so much for all the wonderful responses I get from you on email, on social media, and just the wonderful comments you have, even on reviews. Although there's a select few of you out there that don't like to give good reviews, and I know what you're doing. Shame on you. But for the rest of you who give positive feedback and even who give constructive feedback, I love to hear the people who don't necessarily agree with some of the things on the program but want some things to change. I love you people too. The fact of the matter is, I love people who have skin in the game and want to hear some different things on the program, that love the program. They're invested in the program. Those are the people I love to hear from as well. So thank you, folks. Thank you for sending in your story submissions. Thank you for sending in your parishare story submissions. Thank you for sending in articles for Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, and sending in articles for Supernatural News. It's you guys who keep the show going and keep the energy going and keep Bruiser and I going. You really do make this show a passion for us. It's not necessarily one of those things you do for the money. You do it because you're passionate. You do it because you've got a community of people around you who are just as passionate about the show as you are. And that's what makes it so fun. I mean, this show is fun. So I really do appreciate you guys. So thank you so much for making work fun, because it's really not work. I get up and I play all day. I don't really have a job. I mean, come on. So thank you so much, guys, for making this life so much fun. I thank you so much for that. Have a great weekend, guys. Go out there and have some fun yourselves. We'll be back next week with some great shows for you and great shows going out of August and into September. We're getting closer and closer to a certain paranormal celebrity being on the show and unveiling his brand new biography. Kind of excited about it. Not that I wasn't excited about our friend Daryl today, but a very good book, by the way. And again, the book, The Horrors of the House of Wills, a true story of a paranormal investigator's most terrifying case. But this celebrity, I think, is going to surprise you. I'll give you a little hint in the weeks to come. So there you go. And yes, I will be at Michigan Paracon, so come say hi. That'll do it. Thank you so much for Beer City Bruiser, for Mally Fox, for Jessica Freeberg. I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you for listening to the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio.